From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
Today, Carrie Fisher shares memories of making the first Star Wars when she was 19. Nearly 40 years later, people are still dressing like Princess Leia at Comic-Con conventions.
My favorite one to see is the metal bikini on men. And that is what has been happening a lot. And not thin men, by the way.
Also, we talk with longtime gay rights activist Cleve Jones. His memoir is about his life in the movement and how the movement saved his life twice.
I was planning to kill myself when I was 15 because I thought I was the only queer in the world. And then I read about gay liberation and I decided not to kill myself. And then when I was dying of AIDS and could barely walk, it was all the people who participated in that struggle to change the way the drugs were tested. It absolutely saved my life.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross.
I don't know who you are or where you came from, but from now on, you do as I tell you, okay?
Look, your worshipfulness, let's get one thing straight. I take orders from just one person, me.
It's a wonder you're still alive. Will somebody get this big walking carpet out of my way?
That's Carrie Fisher as Princess Leia and Harrison Ford as Han Solo in the first Star Wars film. Fisher has just written a memoir about making that film. Included in the book is the diary she wrote while shooting the movie when she was having a secret affair with Harrison Ford. The memoir is called The Princess Diarist. Terry spoke with Fisher last Monday.
Carrie Fisher, welcome back to Fresh Air. So what most surprised you that you'd forgotten you'd experienced, but you'd had written about in your journal?
That I was so insecure.
Oh, yeah, that surprised me too, reading excerpt. I'm going to have you read an excerpt a little bit later, but yeah, it seems like you really needed other people to tell you who you were because you didn't know.
At least I knew that. At least I was aware that I didn't know who I was. So that was something, but it was sad to me.
As you've pointed out, in Star Wars, you were the only girl in an all-boy fantasy. When did you start realizing that you were part of boys' sex fantasies?
Not until way later, and I'm very glad of that. Like about maybe 8 years ago, some guy said to me, I thought about you every day from when I was 12 to when I was 22. And I said, every day? And he said, well, four times a day. And, you know, what do you say to that? Thank you?
What do you say to that?
Then I started becoming aware of it in an uncomfortable way.
So what's really made news from your book is your affair with Harrison Ford when you were making Star Wars. He was in his mid-30s and married. You were 19. Did you tell him you were going to write about it before you actually published the book?
Oh, yeah.
I'm really relieved to hear that.
You're relieved?
I'm relieved, yeah.
Oh, no, I wouldn't have ambushed him like that. But it's still, no matter if I told him or not, it probably feels like an ambush. It feels like an ambush to me. I'm the one that wrote it.
Did you tell him or did you ask him for permission?
No, I said I found the journals that I kept during the first movie, and I'm probably going to publish them. And he just sort of raised his finger and said, lawyer. And then I said, no, I won't write anything that you don't want. I mean, I'll show it to you before, and you can take anything out that you want taken out. I don't want to make you uncomfortable, which I, of course, have. Unduly uncomfortable.
So he read it before it was published, and did he ask for any changes?
I sent it to him. I called him. I said, where are you? You know. And I sent it to him. And I never heard back, so I can't imagine that he was comfortable with everything that was in it. But it's not like it's negative about him. It's just a personal story that's been a secret for a long time.
So in your journal that you kept during Star Wars, you write a lot about your relationship with Harrison Ford. And I want to ask you to read an excerpt of that journal. This is where you're describing how Harrison Ford was like a fantasy for you, but the fantasy did not always work out. You kind of projected a lot onto him. So if you could read an excerpt for us.
Sure. We have no feeling for one another. We lie buried together during the night and haunt each other by day, acting out something that we don't feel and seeing through something that doesn't deserve any focus. I have never done anything quite like this. I sit patiently awaiting the consequences. I talk, walk, eat, sleep, patiently awaiting the consequences. How can a thing that doesn't seem to be happening come to an end? George says that if you look at the person that someone chooses to have a relationship with, you'll see what they think of themselves. So Harrison is what I think of myself. It's hardly a relationship, but nevertheless, he is a choice. I examined all the options and chose the most likely to leave. No emotional investments. Never love for me, only obsession. Someone has to stand still for you to love them. My choices are always on the run.
So thank you for reading that. That's Carrie Fisher reading from the journal that she kept during the making of the first Star Wars film, and that excerpts of that journal are included in her new memoir, The Princess Diarist. So, you know, in that excerpt, it seems like this relationship in a way was right for you because you had such low self-esteem and didn't think you deserved somebody who actually was invested in you. And
but I didn't pick him. I mean, I didn't have a crush on him. He even have the nerve to have a crush on him there. I thought he was out of my range, if I even thought about it. He was so much older than I was, and he was married.
So you describe yourself as having a pattern of being obsessed with inaccessible men.
First, I know, but I'm 19 at that time. I have no pattern. I had one boyfriend. When I read that, I felt so sorry for myself at that age. I mean, how can I have a pattern if I'd had one boyfriend? But that's, I guess, how it felt to me. You know, it was as intense as a pattern instead of as a choice. I don't know.
Your relationship with Han Solo, Harrison Ford, in the movie is such the kind of, you know, typical will there or won't they? They hate each other, but that's because they really like each other. And, you know, and so you're having that kind of on-screen relationship. And in real life, you're having an affair. So how did the affair affect the chemistry on screen?
I think it made us more comfortable with one another. I think it made me more able to wisecrack to him, even if I was insecure. We were having an affair, so there was something to base some security on. I don't know. There was chemistry there, and you can see it. So I don't know which came first, the chemistry in the film or the chemistry in the world.
And I mean, your characters end up having a child together.
Well, a really good child, don't you think? We had Hitler. That's sort of perfect. I think that's perfect. Harrison and I have Hitler as a child. And who does he look like? Neither one of us. He's 6'5".
So what was it like for you and Harrison Ford to work together again on the most recent Star Wars film, The Force Awakens? And did he already know you were writing the book? Did you already know you were writing the book?
No, I didn't. I wasn't writing any book. I hadn't found the diaries yet. I found the diaries when we started promoting, when the movie was coming out. And that's when I told him. And I'm sure he would have stopped me if he could have.
But it sounds like you gave him that opportunity.
Well, I gave him the opportunity to take out anything he didn't like.
Right, but not to stop it, yeah.
Yeah, but I don't think it's that revealing, or it's certainly not offensive. It's not unkind about him. It's flattering. I mean, the way people are reacting to it is funny to me, too. I'd do him at 73.
So it sounds like, you know, reading the book, that you had a kind of love-hate relationship with your identity as Princess Leia. It made you a star. It's an iconic role. But there's things you haven't liked about being Princess Leia in the eyes of the world. What's the downside?
No, I actually don't think there is that much of a downside. The downside is the hair. The downside is the hair and some of the outfits. But I like Princess Leia. I like how she handles things. I like how she treats people. She tells the truth. She, you know, gets what she wants done. I don't have a real problem with Princess Leia. I've sort of melded with her over time.
You write in the book that you had endless issues with your appearance, how you looked in Star Wars.
Yes.
And you say, what I saw in the mirror is not apparently what many teenage boys saw. So what did you see when you looked in the mirror?
A giant, fat face like a sand dab with features.
And the hair.
The horrible hair. I just looked like, I don't know, like this really fat-faced, cute, in a not a good way, girl.
Whose idea was it to have the buns on either side of your head?
Well, they kept putting hair on. They kept saying to me, do you like this one? There were some worse ones, if you can imagine. But it was George and the producers. I mean, you know, McDermott, the hairdresser, kept putting hairstyles on me. We kept parading them in front of them. And I don't know. They chose that one. And to put more hair on either side of a round face is going to make it even wider. So that was my problem with that.
So Star Wars was shot in England, where you had been going to school. You were in drama school there. And some of the actors in the film are British. Some of them are American. Your accent is kind of semi-English accent in it.
I know. It's so awful. But I've been going to school there. Well, look, it's not the school, though. It was the dialogue. I thought I recognized your foul stench when I arrived on board. Say that like I just said it. It sounds weird. So it was very arch dialogue. So that's my excuse. And I'm living with it right now.
So were you trying for an English accent or just?
No! No, it was just accidental pretension.
Okay. Well, you're probably also picking up a lot of it just living there. I mean, you have an ear.
Well, I did about a year and a half of Shakespeare and Ibsen and all that. And that dialogue, my dialogue was the most arch of anybody's. Governor Tarkin, I thought I recognized your foul stench when I arrived on board. I mean, who talks like that?
But it wasn't iambic pentameter.
No, but I did do it like I just said it, like a human without a British accent.
Right.
And George said, "This is very serious. You know, you're not being funny about this. That, you know, this everything is on the line here. So you're very serious." So that's where the British. When I'm serious, I'm British. I guess.
Carrie Fisher speaking with Terry Gross. Fisher's new memoir is called The Princess Diarist and includes excerpts of the diary she kept during the making of the first Star Wars film. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Rhodes Scholar, a nonprofit organization providing educational travel adventures, including experiences for families, grandparents, and grandchildren. A catalog is available at roadscholar.org. And from Inada, Japanese maker of full-body massage chairs, including the Flex 3S, with pre-programmed shiatsu massages and full-body stretch sessions, at inadausa.com. That's INADAUSA.com.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's interview with Carrie Fisher. She's written a new memoir called The Princess Diarist about her experiences making the first Star Wars film. It includes the journal she kept at the time.
In the acknowledgments to this new book, included in the acknowledgments are, for my mother, for being too stubborn and thoughtful to die. Your mother is Debbie Reynolds. Did she come close to dying recently?
Yeah.
What happened?
Yeah, no, the whole year was, she had two strokes. And she, as a result of having an abscess on her spine and having to have spine, and she got pneumonia. I mean, it was just, everything that could go wrong went wrong, and it was just the year from hell. And I thought, there were days we thought she was going to die. Yes, she stopped breathing. But, and I said to the nurse once, I said, you know, have you ever seen someone come back from this place? Because she had two words left that she could say. And the woman said, sometimes. And she came back. She's fully back.
She's fully back.
Fully back.
That's great.
I mean, she can't walk as easily. And she's a little more fragile, but she's there.
How old is she now?
84.
So you also thank Donald Light for saving your mother's life and protecting her from demons and whores. What does that mean?
I can't tell you. Something awful.
Okay.
No, just there are certain people around my mother that... No, my mother... Donald stayed with my mother the whole time. And, you know, it was hard. And my mother hates nurses. Oh, my God. I've never seen my mother with bad manners until I saw her with the nurses. But they were telling her what to do, and no one tells my mother what to do. And so I had to say at one point to my mother when she was yelling at a nurse, Mom, not cool. You are my role model. Do you want me to behave like this? Now stop. But it was a year from hell for her. I mean, it was horrible for me to watch her go through all that. But, you know, she's just an amazingly strong woman. And that, it was very hard to write the book. I couldn't write. I couldn't write while this was going on. And that was what I was doing. So I had to rewrite a ton of this book because I couldn't focus.
You had a very contentious relationship with her when you were a teenager, and I think that probably continued into your 20s. And that, you know, you worked in her Broadway show, you were in the chorus of that, you sang in her Broadway act, you know, in her cabaret act for a while. So you worked together. In some ways you were very close, in some ways you were like very far apart. You were anxious to move away from home. How did your relationship change as she became an older woman? Like when you became, like now, like you're middle-aged, she's or older, she's in her 80s. Is the relationship still contentious? Has it changed?
Not at all. I can appreciate it. She's an immensely powerful woman. And I just admire my mother very much. She also annoys me sometimes when she's, you know, mad at the nurses. But, you know, she's an extraordinary woman. Extraordinary. There's very, very few women from her generation who worked like that, who just kept a career going all her life and raised children and had horrible relationships and lost all her money and got it back again. I mean, she's had an amazing life, and she's someone to admire.
Did you appreciate her strength and her accomplishments more as you got older?
Oh, God, yeah. No, when I was a kid, I just thought she was someone who was telling me what to do, and I didn't want to do it.
How did you feel about her celebrity when you were young? Was it helpful? Was it intrusive?
Well, I had to share her. And I didn't like that. When we went out, people sort of walked over me to get to her. And no, I didn't like it. I didn't like it. And I, you know, people thought that, I overheard someone saying, well, she thinks she's so great because she's Debbie Reynolds' daughter. And I didn't like it. It made me different from other people, and I wanted to be the same. I wanted to be, you know, just no different than anybody else.
Your mother's most iconic film is Singing in the Rain, you know, one of the great musicals of all time. What are your thoughts about the movie? And if you like it now, did you always, or did it take you a while to appreciate that film too?
No, I always liked it. It's brilliant. I mean, to do the transition from silent to sound is a brilliant, brilliant time to focus on. And what was interesting to me is that there's three people acting in the movie then. It's two men and a female. And the same with Star Wars. And both movies were sort of, iconic. They did the AFI 10 top films, and one was Singing in the Rain and one was Star Wars.
That's so great you were on the list together.
I know.
You write that you felt doomed to have bad relationships with men. That's what you'd seen. You know, Eddie Fisher, your father, walked out on your mother when you were two to be with Elizabeth Taylor. Your mother's second husband spent all of her money. I mean, left her with nothing.
Left her with nothing, and she had to pay his debts. So future earnings went to him. Everything she made went to his debts, to Harry Carl, who was also having sex with hookers the entire length of their relationship, which she found out later on, and so did we. So it was a very interesting childhood.
Yeah, wow. That must have been upsetting.
Well, yes, I hated him, and then we stayed living with him. But it was the manicurist. It turned out that he had a barber, and the barber was the pimp, and the manicurist were the hookers. So he was having a lot of hookers at the house.
At the house?
At the house, yeah.
Oh, okay. So, did they eventually get divorced? Like, what happened?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, how long did that take?
Yeah, but it took a really long time. She didn't leave him. We went to New York. I went with her to New York to do Irene, to do the play. And she left my brother like a marker with Harry. So he didn't know that they were getting divorced. It was very complicated and very not something you want to do again.
Right. Did you have much of a relationship with your father since he left when you were two?
I did, later on. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have a father-daughter relationship with him. I had a mother-son relationship with him. I took care of him once he got ill.
Do you mean drug ill or health ill?
Well, I think he was not in good shape due to the fact that he took drugs all his life and shot speed and so forth.
Yeah, you mentioned this in your book, yeah.
But he smoked pot all the time when he was older, so we called him Puff Daddy. And I got him a stripper once for his birthday. So that's the kind of relationship we had. It was very unusual. But he wasn't supposed to be a father. He was not a father. He was a lover. So he needed parenting, and I supplied that parenting when he got older. That's the relationship I had.
Did you resent that he walked out on you as a parent and then you ended up parenting him?
No, I didn't. I wanted a relationship with him, and that was the one that was available, so I took it.
Right. You've been very open about your life and, comparatively open about your life.
Spread eagle.
Yeah. And certainly, you know, you're very revealing in your new memoir. Have there been consequences in your life for, you know, what some people might think of as oversharing?
Oh, I think I do overshare, and I sometimes marvel that I do it. But it's sort of, in a way, it's my way of trying to understand myself. I don't know, I get it out of my head. It creates community when you talk about private things and you can find other people that have the same things. Otherwise, I don't know, I felt very lonely with some of the issues that I had or history that I had. And when I shared about it, I found that others had it too.
Have there ever been consequences when someone overshared about you?
No. That would be really hypocritical.
When women dress like you at Comic-Con conventions, what do you most frequently see reflected back at you? Like, which costumes, which hairdos?
Oh, my favorite one to see is the metal bikini on men. And that is what has been happening a lot.
Yeah,
oh, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot. And not thin men, by the way.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, so that makes me feel good about myself. Kind of a before and after thing. This is way after. Not only is Princess Leia fatter, she's a guy.
All right. Carrie Fisher, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for talking to me.
Carrie Fisher's new memoir is called The Princess Diarist, about her experiences making the first Star Wars film. She spoke with Terry last Monday. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of the new novel by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Michael Chabon. It's called Moonglow, and it's loosely based on his grandfather's life. Chabon's other novels include The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, Wonder Boys, and The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay.
The deathbed scene. Literature provides no greater opportunity for melodrama, windy speeches, and schmaltz than the moment when a character who's fading away fast decides to use precious last breaths to talk. The morbid Victorians, in particular, love these set pieces. Dickens' Little Nell, Kathy in Wuthering Heights, Helen Burns in Jane Eyre, all of them went a-gabbing into their good nights. But Michael Chabon, for all his expansive storytelling gifts, is no Victorian. His latest novel, Moonglow, may be structured around the sentimental situation of a dying grandfather telling the secrets of his life to his grandson, but these stories, dozens of them chopped and scrambled, are bawdy and moving, violent and very funny. It's as though the unnamed grandfather here is like Scheherazade, holding off death through an extended bout of yakking. Michael Chabon has said that Moonglow was inspired by a week-long visit he paid to his own dying grandfather in Oakland, California in 1989. Given that the unnamed narrator here is also a novelist, and that this marathon deathbed scene takes place in Oakland, California, we readers are meant to understand that Chabon is tossing together autobiographical truth and the lies of fiction. Indeed, he tells us as much in a prefatory author's note that warns, tongue-in-cheek, that he's taken liberties with the truth with due abandon. This is also one of those novels that features lists and footnotes. I have to tell you that as a reader, I have limited stamina for this kind of thing, unless it's done really well. Meaning, the novelist remembers to entertain the reader as much as they're entertaining themselves. Chabon does it really well. Granted, some subplots seem self-indulgently baroque. Did the teenage grandfather's first sexual encounter have to be with a bearded lady in a railroad yard? But Chabon's narrative energies never flag. He had me on page one with his opening story of how his grandfather was arrested in 1957 for attempting to strangle his boss at the Feathercombs Barrette Company in New York City. Turns out, the grandfather, a salesman, had just been fired in order to open up a position for Alger Hiss, who'd just been released from prison after serving time for perjuring himself about his involvement with a Soviet spy ring. Barrettes and Alger Hiss? You can't make this stuff up, right? Or maybe only a writer like Chabon can. what ensues, and this is a highly pruned plot summary, is a grand story that hops around from the grandfather's juvenile delinquent childhood in Philadelphia to his service in World War II, working in an Army intelligence unit that was hunting down rocket scientist Wernher von Braun in Germany. This life review also includes the grandfather's marriage to a Holocaust survivor, a woman prodded into insanity by nightmare visions of a skinless horse, to his final days hunting down a pet-eating python in his Florida retirement community. These and a multitude of other subplots command attention because they're so highly textured and because Chabon's language is so voluminous and vivid. At the center of this whirlwind of a novel, there's a long, still passage where the narrator and his dying grandfather talk about the point of it all, of life. Here's a snippet of that powerful conversation, beginning with the grandfather's words. You try to take advantage of the time you have. That's what they tell you to do. But when you're old, you look back and you see all you did with all that time is waste it. All you have is a story of things you never started or couldn't finish. I'm ashamed of myself. I'm not ashamed of you, I said. I'm proud. My grandfather made another one of his faces. This face said that what I knew about shame, what my entire generation, with its deployment of confession as a tool for self-aggrandizement, knew about shame, would fit into half a pistachio shell. Yeah, this is why you read Michael Chabon, for the self-deprecation and insight and brio, all packed tight into sentences, fantastic stories, and wild novels that you may think are a world away from where you live, but always turn out to hit home.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Michael Chabon's new novel, Moonglow. Coming up, Terry's interview with gay rights activist Cleve Jones. He's written a memoir called When We Rise, My Life in the Movement. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Squarespace, an all-in-one website builder for bringing a project, business, or portfolio to life online with templates, custom domains, and 24/7 support. Learn more at squarespace.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows and more information are at macfound.org.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Our next guest, longtime LGBTQ activist Cleve Jones, thinks of himself as part of the last generation of homosexuals who grew up not knowing if there was anyone else on the entire planet who felt the way he did. He moved to San Francisco in his early 20s and became active in the gay rights movement. One of his mentors was Harvey Milk, the first openly gay elected official in California, who was assassinated in 1978. Jones was working with the state assembly's speaker on gay rights issues and health issues when the AIDS epidemic started. He went on to co-found the San Francisco AIDS Foundation and conceived the AIDS Memorial Quilt. He's had HIV for many years. Few of his old friends survived the epidemic. His new memoir, When We Rise, My Life in the Movement, is his attempt to describe not only his life, but what his generation fought for, what they lost, and what they won. He will be portrayed by Guy Pearce in an ABC miniseries, also titled When We Rise, scheduled for broadcast in February. In the movie Milk, which starred Sean Penn as Harvey Milk, Jones was portrayed by Emil Hirsch. Jones spoke with Terry last Tuesday.
Cleve Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. Remind us of what the penalties were for having a consensual sexual relationship with somebody of the same gender when you were a teenager, knowing that you were gay. And we're talking about the 1960s.
The penalties for homosexual conduct would vary from state to state, but it was a felony in most states, punishable with prison terms of varying lengths.
So when you knew that you were gay, were you afraid that someday you would be arrested?
Yes, when I began to understand what the words meant that were being tossed my way, I went to my father's library. He was a psychologist, and looked it up. And, you know, it was pretty horrifying for a 13, 14-year-old kid to learn suddenly that his feelings are not only deemed criminal, but psychologically an illness. So that was the reality for my generation, growing up in a world in which we were criminalized and considered to be ill.
And were a lot of people imprisoned for gay relationships back then?
Even in San Francisco, thousands of gay men were arrested, usually using entrapment techniques, every single year for sexual behavior between consenting adults. That continued well into the 1970s until it was finally decriminalized in 1976, I believe.
So you were afraid to tell your parents that you were gay, in part because your father's a psychologist. You were afraid that he'd sign you up against your will for aversion therapy or electroshock therapy. How seriously did you worry about that?
Well, I was very concerned about it, and I delayed telling my parents until I was 18 so that they would no longer have the legal right to have me committed and be subjected to these procedures that are really pretty barbaric. And, you know, I think those fears were well-founded because for the first couple of years after I came out, there was very little contact with him, and he really wanted me to be cured, and I kept saying there's nothing to cure. Later, we were able to reconcile somewhat.
And you write that you were hoarding pills. It sounds like you had a suicide plan just in case. What was the just in case?
Yeah, I felt that my life was over before it even really began, because it just seemed then that there was no way to have a decent life and to be gay. So I was terrified that I was going to be caught, and I'd already experienced quite a bit of bullying, and I just thought that only misery lay ahead, and that when I got caught, that would be the solution. And I wish I could say that was a thing of the past, but you know it's not. And even today, every year, we lose an awful lot of young people, teenagers, who take their own lives because they are gay or transgender.
So you found out that there was like a gay movement through being a Quaker. You and your mother went to Quaker meetings. She went to Quaker meetings because she wanted to be a Quaker so you'd have a reason to avoid the draft. This was during the Vietnam War. So how did going to Quaker meetings lead to your discovery of the gay rights movement?
The Quakers were very welcoming. And even back then, I think they were performing commitment ceremonies for same-sex couples. But really, the big news for me came not at Quaker meeting, but through Life magazine. And it was the Year in Review issue of 1971. They had a big spread called Homosexuals in Revolt, and I think it was 8 or 9 pages of text and photographs. And it was just the most astonishing thing for me. Stonewall, the rebellion in New York, Greenwich Village, had happened just 2 years prior, but if you were a teenage kid in Phoenix, Arizona, you didn't know about that. So this magazine, in a matter of minutes, revealed to me that there were other people like me, there were a lot of us, that we were organizing, that there was a community, and there were places where we could live safely, and that one of those places was called San Francisco.
So you met Harvey Milk. He became a mentor to you. Yeah. How would you describe his importance in the gay rights movement?
Well, he's often described as the first openly gay person to be elected to public office. That's inaccurate. And in my book, I make sure to credit the half dozen or so individuals who came before him in various places in the country. But I think that Harvey's significance really was that he became our first shared martyr. The word of his assassination spread far and wide. And even though gay people had lost many people to violence, to suicide, to drugs and alcohol, here was this symbolic figure that just struck a chord with people. For those of us in San Francisco, it was fascinating to see this guy who was really just kind of, you know, like one of your local neighborhood characters assume this worldwide significance.
So in 1977, Anita Bryant led a campaign to overturn a gay rights ordinance in Dade County, Florida. And after winning, she vowed to take that campaign nationwide. So after her group kind of won in 1977, there was a big protest in San Francisco. And, you know, Harvey Milk helped channel, you see, he helped channel the anger into a march. So describe him in action during that protest.
Harvey was very smart and really good at working with crowds of people, and he did not want violence. He understood that there were times in history when violence was inevitable, I would hate to say useful, but he did not want violence and he didn't want it in our neighborhood. So when people were angry, when people were frightened, he would bring us all together so we could have that sense of power that comes from being together in the street and taking over the street. And then he would march us, and we created this march route that went for miles and miles up and down some of the steepest hills in San Francisco. And the main reason we did this was, first, of course, to show our anger and our determination, but also to make sure that by the end of it, everybody would be too tired to break windows or fight the police.
Really? That was part of the strategy?
It was march them till they drop. That was the strategy. And there were so many times when we would go roaring through town at, you know, 11 o'clock at night, tens of thousands of people screaming bloody murder, but without breaking a single window or injuring a single person.
Yeah, you say that Harvey Milk's attitude was don't burn down your neighborhood.
Yeah.
You got a job with the State Assembly of California to work on gay rights and to monitor the Assembly's health committee and serve as the liaison between the committee's Democratic members and the Speaker, who was Leo McCarthy. And that's how you first found out about AIDS before that word was known. You had to, as part of your job, read the CDC's weekly morbidity and mortality report. And back in 1981, you read about something called pneumocystis pneumonia. Did you realize right away that this was something that was going to decimate a lot of the gay community? Like, what was the first article about it that you read? What were the clues?
It was the first week of June 1981, and I read in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report about these cases of pneumocystis pneumonia and Kaposi's sarcoma among young, previously healthy homosexual men. And I remember being very puzzled by it and alarmed. I cut it out and put it on the bulletin board at my office. About a month later, the New York Times did their first story about it, and I cut that out too. And about the same time, I got a call from Dr. Marcus Conant, who was a dermatologist at the University of California, San Francisco. And he wanted to talk with me because he knew that I worked for the Democratic leadership, and he was already predicting that we were going to need to raise and spend significant sums of money for research and treatment. So he took me to dinner and told me that he thought it was a new virus, sexually transmitted, maybe dormant for many, many years, that it attacked the immune system in some way that he couldn't understand and was fatal. And there was something about the way he delivered this information that just went right to my heart. And I knew that night. And I, you know, I looked up at him and I said, well, then we're all dead. And he said, you know, maybe. He then took me to meet a young man who was dying at the UCSF hospital. His name was Simon. And, you know, he was in an isolation ward. And it was pretty horrifying to see close up what the disease did to him. That was June of 1981. By the fall of 1985, almost everyone I knew was dead or dying or caring for someone who was dying.
When were you diagnosed?
I tested positive for HIV the week the test came out, which I'm thinking was 1985. That time is a bit of a blur, but yeah, I tested positive, and I had been in a study I had volunteered for, so that I knew that they had samples of my blood going back all the way to 1977. So I learned that not only did I have HIV, but I learned that I'd had it since the winter of 78-79. So I never expected to survive.
And you almost didn't.
I didn't get seriously ill until 1993. And then I got very sick. My immune system collapsed. And I was also allergic to many of the drugs used to treat the opportunistic infections, particularly pneumocystis pneumonia. So I moved out into the woods. I got a little cabin out in the Redwood Forest north of San Francisco and thought that would be as good as a good place as any to finish up. And Dr. Koenig got me in one of these first studies for what we now call the cocktail. And it was a combination of three drugs, and I responded almost immediately. So that was November of 94.